The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, the show that's all about creating a better workplace and developing positive relationships where people can thrive. I'm Roy Saunderson, and I'm here today with my colleague Max Brown, and we're from the Recognition Management Institute. It's good to be doing another show with you, Max.
Absolutely, Roy. I'm really looking forward to this show.
Great, and I am too. And our guest today is Matthew Bishop, the U.S. Business Editor and New York Bureau Chief of The Economist. Matthew is the co-author of the recent book, The Road from Ruin, How to Renew Capitalism and Put America Back on Top. And Philanthrocapitalism, which I've been reading, his previous book, has been described as the definitive guide to a new generation of philanthropists. Mr. Bishop is the author of several of The Economist's special report supplements. And before joining The Economist, Mr. Bishop was on the faculty of the London Business School, where he co-authored three books for the Oxford University Press on subjects ranging from privatization and regulation to corporate mergers. He has served as a member of the Sykes Commission on the Investment System in the 21st Century. He was also on the advisors group of the United Nations International Year of Microcredit in 2005. He was also honored as a young global leader by the World Economic Forum and has been interviewed on numerous media outlets, including NPR, BBC, CNBC, and the Charlie Rose Show. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
It's great to be with you.
Good, good. Well, I tell you, you're taking us in a completely different angle with this whole concept of capitalism and how we can relate that to creating better workplaces. How has capitalism evolved, would you say, in the last couple of years with all we've been going through?
Well, you know, as you say, the theme of much of my work really is about the relationship between capitalism and the workplace and our humanity, and how do we actually make sure that the way capitalism is working actually makes us in the workplace more fulfilled as people and makes the companies that we work for actually, you know, build a better society. That was the theme of philanthrocapitalism. It's also the theme of, you know, one of the underlying messages of the Road from Ruin. And the starting point of the Road from Ruin is that when Wall Street melted down back in September 2008, it revealed real fundamental problems in our capitalism. And in particular, one of the big problems was that the whole system had become incredibly short-term focused, particularly on Wall Street, where people really focused on whatever would increase short-term profits and get the share price up in the short run, and felt that that focus should be at the expense of, you know, some underlying questions about whether those organizations and the work people were doing on Wall Street was actually benefiting society. Mm-hmm. And I think we should have been having, in the last 18 months since then, a real debate about how do we reorientate and refocus capitalism so that it does clearly benefit society. And unfortunately, I think we've had a lot of shouting out of Washington and a few reforms, some of which make sense, some of which don't. And then in Wall Street, we've had a sort of extraordinary demonstration of the power of denial, where a lot of people have just blinded themselves to the fact that there were real questions to be answered. So we haven't seen the kind of progress that I wish and think we desperately need to have.
Well, you raise an interesting question for me, and that is, I know you speak about, you know, bad business can't be built on bad values. Why did we let the value system just kind of deteriorate to the point where we've had this economic setback?
You know, I think that's a really good question. You know, I think partly it's the point that, I mean, John Maynard Keynes famously said that practical men, when you dig beneath the surface, are turn out to be slaves to some defunct economist. And the idea basically is that there's some ideas that were commonplace in economics 25, 30 years ago that finally, you know, filter through in a very distorted form into the practical affairs of the government and of business. Mm-hmm. By the time they do, they're out of date. And I think the idea, one of the intellectual ideas that was very big in academia in the 1970s was the efficient market theory. And that theory basically said that whatever the share price says, you know, is the best guess about real value in capitalism.
Okay, yeah.
And so people began to worship the share price, and people's pay was structured around the share price. Profit maximization, as expressed in the share price, you know, was seen as the only judge of whether a firm was doing any good. And you had people like Milton Friedman say things like the only social responsibility of business is to maximize profits, and so forth. And so, you know, and you had things like the famous Gordon Gekko speech in Wall Street, the movie, you know, greed is good.
Mm-hmm.
And that was regarded as, that was supposed to be a parody and a satire at the time, but it sort of entered into the mindset of Wall Street because somehow the share price was equated with virtue, social virtue, almost people did start to believe that greed was good, and that became pervasive and institutionalized across the system. And so, you know, I think what's been discredited now is the efficient market theory. I think the fact that you can have massive bubbles of the kind we've had means mm-hmm. that no one can simply say, oh, the share price has gone up, that means we're doing the right thing. And I think that mm-hmm. means that people now should be freed up to answer some, to ask some pretty deep questions about, you know, how much value really does Wall Street add to our economy? Does the way it works at the moment improve capitalism? Because there are actually some great business leaders out there, mostly outside of Wall Street, who do want to try and tackle climate change or try and you know, deal with poverty issues and, you know, some of the challenges of helping developing economies be better societies as well as wealthier societies. And yet, you know, I think capitalism is, through Wall Street, has worked against those business leaders rather than
right.
supporting them as it should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about trying to deal with those social issues, whether it be, you know, climate change or other social things, you've coined this term philanthrocapitalism, and I appreciate you kind of just defining that for our listeners who might not be familiar with it. And tell us a little bit how it plays a role in our lives and how it's creating a bit of a global revolution for us.
Well, philanthrocapitalism is a concept that I defined, which is about how capitalism, you know, is reconnecting or should be reconnecting with the question of how do we build a better society for everybody. And so philanthropy means for the good of humanity. And so we've taken the philanthropy part and the capitalism part and put them together. And the idea of the book really came out of being present in the New York Public Library in June 2006 when Warren Buffett and Bill Gates stood on stage together, then the two richest and most successful business people of our age, and pledged to give away, you know, most of their money to address the needs of the most impoverished and needy people on the planet. And it just struck me that that was a unique moment in history. We'd never seen two such prominent business people before pledge to give away so much money to help the poor. And I wanted to understand why they'd done that. Were they representative of something in capitalism that was going on, some new phenomenon?
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, I mean, two things. One is that they were part of actually a long historical trend that there had been throughout history great periods of success for capitalism where the biggest winners, the people who created the greatest wealth, also some of them gave back in ways that were spectacular and helped build a better society for everybody. But also that, you know, they were, Gates and Buffett are the tip of an iceberg, and there's a lot of other, a lot of younger business people who are now trying to even do, make their money in ways that are clearly benefiting society in a way that, the way they structure their business and so forth. So if you look at the people who founded Google, I think they really, you know, when they went public as a company, Google actually said, we're going to give away 1% of our equity, 1% of our profits, and 1% of our employees' time towards philanthropy, but also that the culture of the company is one of do no evil, which is a very different sort of language. And one can be a bit cynical about it, but at times. But I think overall, that's a mission they've tried to embrace as a company, and the people who work there, you know, are turned on by that kind of culture.
Right, and I think that's a part where it is kind of moving towards getting more employee involvement. In our final few minutes for this particular segment, Matthew, how has social and corporate responsibility become an important part of today's society?
Well, I think companies are going through a lot of change on this area of what it means to be a corporate citizen, a responsible part of society. And it would be an exaggeration to say that this was all companies. I mean, there are clearly some fairly bad firms out there as well. But I think what's happened over the last 20 years is you've gone from a situation where the Milton Friedman view was widely accepted. You know, business, the social responsibility of business was to make money, to one where people have realized that actually, if you really want to make money in the long run, you need to be on the right side of progress for society, and you need to be seen to be playing an active role. You're not going to solve all society's problems as a business, because you do have to make money, and that does limit what you can do. But on the other hand, if you're not part of the solution, then you're likely to lose out in the long run. And so you see companies like Nike, which was famously on the wrong side of history 20 years ago, exploiting lots of people in the
sweatshop,
developing world, sweatshops and so forth, has done a complete U-turn and is now probably one of the most progressive companies out there in terms of actually helping, for example, spread responsible sex education in Africa, messages and that kind of thing. So it's really turned on its head, because I think it's realized that actually those people it was exploiting in its sweatshops are tomorrow's customers. And besides any other sense of ethics, it's got to make sure your customers of tomorrow are not going to buy from you if they know that you were there, they were your exploited workers of yesterday. So I think companies started to realize that. And then you've got a company like Walmart, which, again, terrible public image 10 years ago or less even, has now embraced green products.
Green moment,
in a way that I think has gone way beyond what they thought they were doing when they started to do it, in a way that's really engaged many Walmart people who work at Walmart. I mean, it's a very, very dramatic change in the culture of that company. And, I think one could pick loads of other examples as well. But I think there is something going on here which reflects the fact that workers want to nowadays increasingly want to work for a company they believe in, and they don't just want to be working at a company because it's going to pay them a lot. And also that consumers want a company that they're buying from to have made the products in a way that they feel easy with in their conscience. They don't want to be wearing fancy shoes that have been made by exploited labor anymore.
No, and I think you're right. And Matthew, you kind of really helped me gain a better perspective, not only through your book, but through this conversation. And I'm very excited to continue on as we go through the show to know how we can kind of get employees connected and involved in this whole process as well. So it's time for us to take a short break. This is Roy Saunderson and Max Brown with our guest today, Matthew Bishop. And you're listening to Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. Please stay tuned as we discuss more about philanthrocapitalism and the way that it can be a social responsibility versus an oxymoron.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and myself, Max Brown, and our guest today, Matthew Bishop, the U.S. Business Editor and the New York Business Bureau Chief of The Economist. Matthew, thank you, and welcome back to the show. Just before that break, you were talking a lot about, okay, so where is this going and why people have changed, and even cited a few organizations that have changed. Do you feel like some of this I'm just wondering, is it sincere or is it more of a PR stunt?
I think you have to judge this on a case-by-case basis. In some companies, it's more PR than mm-hmm. sincere. But I do think that there's been a real change over the last 10 years. That mm-hmm. 10 years ago, there was a lot more PR and a lot less substance to it. But I think what's now happened is that a lot of organizations that were doing this for superficial reasons have started to understand that the world has changed, and that you look at the number of big multinationals who now say, our customers tomorrow are going to be in what we would call developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
That is where they expect their growth to come from, particularly because they're gloomy about the outlook for America, the outlook for Europe. They think there's not going to be a lot of growth here mm-hmm. and in Europe, and so they need to get not just workers, cheap workers from developing world, but wealthy customers. And I think once they started to realize that, it's turned on the head the strategy that they pursue. So if you all say, for example, Coca-Cola, you've had a terrible time in India, for example, because you've been accused of contaminating the water supply mm-hmm. at a company. And so that is really bad for your brand in India. And now what you're seeing is that Coca-Cola is very ambitious plans to work with nonprofits to manage the water system in the countries where it operates, so that they have sustainable water that meets the needs of the populations of those countries. And as you know, I mean, water is going to be the great battleground over the next 25 years as the world population grows and water supply is scarce. Mm-hmm. And so for a company like Coca-Cola, if it can genuinely be on the right side of that debate, that's going to be great for its customers, in that it will have a sustainable water supply. It's great for its own license to operate in those countries, because I guess the more that water is a political battleground, the more people are going to be saying, well, why is our scarce water being used to make sickly fizzy drinks?
Mm-hmm.
So it can nullify that issue. But more than that, it can actually be seen as, this is a company that's actually been helping to solve this big problem in India or in Africa, rather than one that's making it worse. And so, I think there's lots and lots of companies that are in a similar situation. And so that means that this idea of doing well by doing good is not just a slogan, but actually, if companies go about it by looking at what their core business strategy is for the next 10 or 20 years for growth, and trying to make sure that the doing good they do is embedded in their core business strategy, then they really could have a win-win on their hands, which is a win for themselves and their shareholders and a win for society.
Yes, it's very holistic, isn't it? As opposed to just looking at how to maximize profit, this is a way of saying, hey, this is still in our best interest. We do make more money this way as well.
Mm, precisely. And I think one of the problems that we've had with capitalism, which I write about in The Road from Ruin, is that this short-term focus that's been imposed on companies has meant that even though you've had business leaders that understand that their long-term best interests are served by doing well by doing good strategies, that they've not been able to justify that to their shareholders, persuade their shareholders to back it, because the shareholders say, well, that's getting involved in water supply management in the developing world, what's that got to do with the next quarter's profits or the next year's profits? Mm. And so if it costs you money, they're saying, well, why are you spending that money? And they're criticizing management when they should be saying, wow, this is a brilliant, potentially brilliant investment that's going to pay off handsomely over the next 10 or 20 years.
Mm.
And so you found that management has been discouraged from thinking long-term in this way. And hopefully one of the things that will come out of this crisis of capitalism will be that the long-term view is taken much more seriously, and that shareholders say, yeah, we want managers who understand the way society is operating. They understand that the world is hopefully going to get richer, but as it does so, it needs to rebuild and redesign its governance and its the way it manages all sorts of its social problems, and we want to be part of that solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that and so instead of just taking a short-term view, which has been a challenge to companies, that hopefully we can get beyond that and think of the bigger impact here as well. What other challenges are companies facing beyond this short-term view? What other challenges do you think that they have to be aware of as they face this, go into this new future?
Well, I think one challenge is that they're going to be, they are still going to be treated with a fair amount of skepticism. Secondly, is that when you go out on a limb and say, we're going to try and be on the side of good, social progress, that you raise the bar for yourself. You become a more natural focus of public attention. So, for example, if you're an oil company that ahead of every other oil company says, actually, we've got to ultimately prepare for a world where we don't survive on oil anymore. We've got to invest in wind energy and solar energy renewables, and we're going to go, to coin a phrase, beyond petroleum. If you then pollute the Gulf of Mexico because you've been incompetent as an oil company, you're going to get even more cynicism and abuse in the public domain than you would do if you were a company like ExxonMobil that said there's no such thing as climate change for 10 years was sort of pretty terrible in its attempt to position itself as a force for good. So, there are risks in terms of, you put your head above the parapet, you're going to risk getting shot at. And, I think other risks are, for example, there's all sorts of challenges. For example, I think the best of these new, more enlightened companies, the part of their successful strategy is that they've managed to work as partners with non-profits and with governments. And that requires a different sort of leadership skill, management skill from those company leaders. You can't just tell a non-profit what to do in the way that you can tell your own staff what to do. You can't tell a government what to do. And you've got to actually be a collaborative person, a team player, a partner. And I think that's been a bit of a culture shock in some cases. But actually it turns out that you are in some ways sharing your brand with a non-profit that has got quite a different agenda. So one of the examples I'm fascinated about at the moment is that the private equity firm called KKR, Carlberg, Gravis and Roberts, which is in many ways one of the traditional capitalism beasts of the jungle. It was famously the subject of a book in the 1980s called Barbarians at the Gate. But it's got a partnership now. KKR is in partnership with Environmental Defense, which is an incredibly well-respected non-profit. And basically, the partnership allows Environmental Defense to go into every company that KKR owns and to look at their businesses and say, here are ways that we think you can reduce your carbon footprint and then reduce your negative impact on the environment. And Environmental Defense takes no money from KKR. Because it's to maintain its integrity. But, that's a risky relationship, both for the non-profit but also for KKR, that KKR may say, we looked at KKR, we came up with these ideas, they didn't implement them, therefore we're going to break the relationship off and criticize them very loudly, and that's a risk for a manager. So there are all sorts of challenges like that, and there are challenges which are basically that these are very difficult problems.
Mm-hmm.
Managing the water supply in a sustainable way in a country where government is very weak is a real challenging problem, much more challenging maybe than making Coca-Cola.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Harvard Business Review just recently, Umar Haque, if I pronounce his name correctly, wrote an article called Why Betterness is Good Business. And to summarize, he said essentially what you've said in philanthrocapitalism, that these good companies, while the risks might be there and the challenges are certainly wicked issues, if you will, there is great interest and actually powerful opportunity for both sides to create this win-win. And that's what he was summarizing there by saying, hey, you actually do more, you make more, when we treat our people better inside, when we actually have better social impact. In fact, I love one of the quotes. He actually said, so you're profitable, and then he put yawn, yawn, yawn. What have you done to create a social impact? And I thought that was quite a question to leave.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, one of the lessons that I take from this crisis, which again we write about in The Road from Ruin, is that the data, the things that we celebrated in terms of measurements of progress, were the wrong things. That, you know, we looked at GDP growth and higher short-term profits as our benchmarks, when in fact we should be really now focusing on, can we come up with better data that measure overall our progress as a society? Are we, you know, is there something that we can supplement GDP with that actually says not only is our income getting higher, but our overall quality of life and happiness in our society is growing? And at the company level, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, I don't think we're there yet, but I think we need to come up with triple bottom line measures of success. So it's not just profit, but it's also social and environmental impact. Now, those numbers are going to be, there's a lot of debate about how you actually get good measures of triple bottom line, but I think conceptually we've got to recognize that we need to do that analysis, and that we need to make that a priority urgently. Otherwise, we're going to, you know, keep celebrating companies that you know, seem to deliver good profits in the short run, but actually don't have any positive social impact and may actually be making money by having a negative social impact.
Right. So we talk about this a lot, and you see this a lot in media today. You make some amazing points about why we believe this is important, but I really want to know, how are we going to make this sustainable so it's not just a fad or a trend or, like we said, a PR statement? And you mentioned, you know, that a lot of people are realizing this is a win-win now and that they're making more money as a result. But is there a possibility that this could be unsustainable, or are we actually looking at this for the future and this isn't going away?
Well, you know, I think that, as I say, the underlying economic forces are very strongly in favor of this trend, because, you know, you hear companies, as I say, they talk about future growth is going to come from emerging markets. And you look at emerging markets, and basically there's a lot of problems in terms of their societies. They're often poorly governed. The rule of law isn't great. They don't have much civil society. They don't have the things that we take for granted, you know, in a developed economy. And so if companies really want those markets to expand quickly so they can make more money, they have to help solve those social problems and create the social structures that are needed. Secondly, the biggest question, the biggest challenge that you hear as you talk to company leaders today is, how are we going to win the war for talent? You know, there is a real scarcity of the kind of people that companies think they need to succeed in the long run. And it turns out that one of the factors that it makes a big difference as to whether a company can hire someone or not is the values of that company. You know, is that company
Absolutely.
About more than just making money? Is it about, you know, actually doing positive things in the world? And is there a mission that people can believe in? And I think those two factors together, plus the fact that consumers in the developed world as well are increasingly able to see through the internet and so forth how the products that they consume have been made and whether they've been made in a progressive or an exploitative way. All those factors are coming together to create real constraints to mean that it has to be more than just PR, that it has to be real. And if it's not real, then the people will be found out very fast. And so companies have to take this stuff seriously.
Well, I appreciate that, Matthew. The obviously transparency for the future, that people want to do more than just make money. They want to have meaning in their lives. And you've pointed these things out in the book. Grateful to have you on the show today. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will continue with where this is headed, what will corporations be able to do for the future to be competitive, and talk more with our guest, Matthew Bishop, on social and corporate responsibility and where this leads us for the future. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson, and we'll be right back.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with myself, Roy Saunderson, and Max Brown. And our guest today, Matthew Bishop, the U.S. Business Editor and New York Bureau Chief of The Economist. Matthew, as we were just leading up to that last break there, I know you were talking a little bit about the war for talent that is certainly a challenge as people are starting to come out of the economic setbacks. How can corporations expect that engagement factor, the discretionary effort that is often associated with engagement, if they aren't doing anything meaningful in return for what they're producing?
Well, I think that's right. I think companies have to, if they really want to get people committed to them, they have to be able to demonstrate that they are, you know, not just talking the talk but walking the walk. And I think, you know, increasingly companies are at least saying the right things. But the real progress that I'm looking for over the next few years is to see this go much, much deeper. That, you know, I think that it's going to be an issue that you need the chief executive of a company to be taking the lead on, to actually be, actually speaking to staff about this being core to the business strategy, not just, you know, CSR in department or the corporate foundation, but actually something that he or she is absolutely passionate about and driving through the company. And,
yes.
You know, I think those sorts of chief executives are going to find that they are able to inspire their workers and get much more out of them than those CEOs that take the stuff, either leave it to someone else to deal with or don't really show much passion about it.
You also spoke about maybe we've been measuring the wrong thing and things like GDP per capita and things like that. And I remember, isn't it a country like Bhutan, if I remember rightly, they have a global happiness index. And I'm just kind of curious to know what kind of measures you think is going to be moving those stakeholders, those shareholders that you say are kind of not got it yet. What kind of measures are going to be meaningful to those shareholders to kind of really commit organizations and companies to do the right thing?
Well, first point is I think we need to recognize that the measures we've got are not adequate at the moment. I think it's still not as widely accepted as it ought to be that that's the case. But it seems to me that this crisis, as we write in the Woven Ruin, this crisis really has revealed not just toxic assets, but toxic ideas. And one of the toxic ideas is that the measurements that are short-term, that focus on just economic, just on financial measures of success, don't tell us enough, and that actually they can lead us badly astray. So we recognize there's a problem. Let's recognize that. And then secondly, we need to launch a real sort of crusade to actually come up with better data. And I can't predict what the answers will be, but I think there are already a lot of bright people who've been thinking about issues like how do you supplement GDP, and they've been thinking about that issue for 20 or 30 years. As you say, Bhutan has this measure of global gross domestic happiness. But I'm pretty skeptical that that particular set of measures is really getting at the whole truth. I think it needs to be improved a lot. I wouldn't particularly want to live in Bhutan. I prefer New York, and I think our measures need to actually not sort of embody some idea that some rural idyll from the 18th century is the way we want to live today. I think it needs to be compatible with the modern world that we live in and the aspirations of people living in that modern world. But I do think that we are there's lots of evidence that, for example, if you look back at all that economic growth that we had in the early part of this decade, this last decade, yeah, that was associated with all sorts of warnings about how many people were living way beyond their means, that they were, you know, they were using their houses as ATMs, they were getting deep in debt. And there's plenty of reasons to think that, that actually, while the GDP number was going up, the happiness level of a lot of people and their ability to survive economic downturn was getting worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And we need to actually be able to say, have measures of that. You know, I think we need a measure of, like, what's the resilience of a household, its ability of a household to survive a recession. That ought to be something that we have an index on. And there is actually also more broadly an initiative going on that unfortunately is led by the president of France, which means it probably won't be taken seriously by anyone in America. But it's called there's a Sarkozy commission with Joe Stiglitz to look at replacing GDP with some kind of measure of happiness. Mm-hmm. And we should take those issues seriously. It's interesting to me that in the Great Depression back in the 1930s, one of the lessons that politicians took from that crisis was that the economic data they had was completely useless, and that's when you saw the invention of GDP data.
I see.
And there was an economist called Simon Kuznets who led that initiative, and he was, by the end of the 1930s, he wanted to include in GDP a measure of work done in the house as part of GDP, which is not part of our GDP now at the moment because the Commerce Department vetoed it. Mm-hmm. And you think, how would our economy look now if we were measuring that kind of work as part of our overall measure of the economy, like what people do at home, the mm-hmm. work people do there? And so those sorts of questions need to be addressed now, and they nearly got addressed in the 1930s, but this crisis ought to be an opportunity for us to tackle them today. And then if you look at companies, there's been a lot of work around something called triple bottom line, where people are trying to measure not just profits, but also social impact and environmental impact. And I would say the work has gone furthest in terms of understanding environmental impact. You do see a number of companies now produce environmental reports that are audited by an external auditor. And I think one of the challenges with all this data is that you need to get an independent auditor, so mm-hmm. it's not just companies making it up for PR purposes.
Gotcha.
But, you know, I think investors are going to have to drive this process. And I think it's clear that investors have been asking companies to disclose far more about their environmental costs, their energy efficiency, their carbon footprint.
Yeah.
And I think I want to see them also ask those questions about their social impact, their human capital, the extent to which they're able to, you know, make a difference in the world. And I think people, once we start to get disclosure from companies, we can then start to figure out what actually generates higher profits and the extent to which doing good really mm-hmm. does allow companies to do well. And there's a whole sort of school of thought about blended value, which is about how can you measure trade-offs between profits and social impact and environment, and actually understand the trade-offs that are being made much better. We're also seeing some institutional investors start to measure their social impact. So there's been, in the last year, an organization called the Global Impact Investing Network that's been created, which is not just a fringe group, but includes firms like J.P. Morgan, and includes the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and includes some big pension funds, where they're saying, well, let's try and measure the not just the financial impact, but the social impact of the money we invest, and let's try and develop some measurements that really work. So this idea of a crusade for much better data is not just a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as boring as it sounds. It's actually really important.
Well, it's actually starting
to happen.
Yes, well, and that's a good thing. Now, how do companies, you know, you talk about the human capital investment there, you talk about getting above the bottom line. How are companies supposed to fully engage their employees as we move forward in the next several years? What's your thoughts on that?
There are a number of thoughts there. One is that, you know, I think the more companies are communicating with their workers and getting them involved in the work of doing good, the better. And I think the more companies realize that this is not just a thing, an add-on on the side of the business, but is integral to their strategy, the more that's likely to happen. So you take Walmart, for example, where they have this commitment to climate change to fighting climate change and to creating green products. It's not just something that is the head office. It's every business, you know, every Walmart employee is encouraged to have their own personal goals in terms of climate, of energy reduction and so forth. And there are discussions that go on amongst groups of employees in Walmart stores about how they can improve each store and the energy efficiency. And then there's active groups that are looking for lessons learned in one store and figuring out how to spread it quickly around the organization. So you've got a whole culture change operation that's taken place kind of almost, I think, unexpectedly. I don't think Lee Scott, who was then the chairman of Walmart, had any idea what he was unleashing when he started this process. But you know, what you found is the whole workforce is getting empowered by this cause of how do we make Walmart into a green company. I think a couple of companies have this thing called the 1% formula. So Salesforce.com and then Google both adopted this idea, which is that we give away 1% of our equity, 1% of our profits, but also 1% of our employees' time. And so every employee knows that they're going to have paid time where they're going to be encouraged to go and work on some kind of good community project or work with a non-profit. Now, I again think there's a huge opportunity to figure out how do you get the real value out of the employees that you're lending to non-profits, because non-profits have a lot of needs of high quality input. They don't want someone to come from they don't want a brilliant accountant or lawyer to come work with them and spend their time painting. They actually probably want them to come and provide their expertise as a lawyer or as an accountant. And I think there's some real challenges to how do you make those relationships between employees and non-profits really deliver. But I think having that built into your job description is that you will spend some time. You're expected to actually go out and be involved in your community and in working with a non-profit to do something useful. I think that changes the culture of a company and makes more employees more likely to work for you. Certainly Salesforce, Mark Benioff at Salesforce tells me that it really, really helps in their recruitment for people to that company, because people say, well, if you're a company that's willing to give me time off and pay me to actually go out and do something useful in the community, then you must really care about this stuff.
Absolutely. Well, Matthew, you continue to enlighten us with your thoughts on how capitalism can be woven into social responsibility, and we're very grateful for that. Come back for our final segment with our guest today, Matthew Bishop, for Real Recognition Radio. This is Roy Sonnison and Max Brown reminding you to keep it real.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Sonnison and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about: getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. Let's continue our conversation with Matthew Bishop, our guest today, and learn some final pointers on social and corporate responsibility. Matthew, we've talked a lot about how companies going forward will find this in their best interest as a win-win, and how employees are looking for something more than money, but they're looking for meaning. And there's a lot of reports out there on these topics. it actually makes me wonder, will there be a need for unions in the future if we're taking such good care of our employees that feel like there's passion and meaning? And what's your take on that?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I suppose I have a number of responses to that. One is I don't think that, one of the things that companies in the modern world are going to do is be necessarily a place where you can expect to work for the whole of your career. And so mm-hmm. I think job security is not going to be necessarily high on the agenda of many of these companies, even as they try and do good in society in general, I think. And that may create all sorts of tension. I mean, I think certainly if you look at Walmart, it's going to continue to have probably questions about its opposition to unions. And I can't see the fact that it's taken climate change seriously as an issue is going to affect its attitude to unions. Equally, though, I mean, I think there's also a crisis in the union movement in that I think the union movement historically has played a very, very important role in raising standards in the workplace. But I think at some level, at some point in time, it got itself stuck in many ways on the wrong side of history, that it started to be more about protecting workers inside a company against change in the real world and denying the reality of the global trends in the global economy. So the union movement failed to modernize itself. And it's interesting that you are seeing new models of unionism emerge. For example, I love the Freelancers Union, which is a product of some social entrepreneurs, a social entrepreneur in New York, which is really about representing people who are freelancers, who don't actually have a particular tie to a particular company, but actually don't have or haven't had good enough healthcare, have real problems of uneven cash flow, which makes it difficult for them to save for their retirement and so forth. And so, this new model of unionism is far more about using social networking and all these modern trends to educate them, to provide bulk buying power for financial products for retirement, and less about the GM type model of attempting to basically run the company and using strike power a lot to bring about what they want. So there's all sorts of interesting questions going on there about the future of unionism. I think I certainly don't think that you can rely on companies to do the right thing all the time, and so there should certainly be the right, particularly in the developing world, that you'd expect to see a greater role for organized labor to protect itself. But on the other hand, I don't venerate the old trade unions that fail to get to grips with the needs of the modern worker, particularly in the richer parts of the world. So this is going to be an area where we see a lot of, I hope, lots of new models and new thinking coming up over the next few years.
Well, with all this in mind, and obviously with the lessons learned of the past even decade as you've talked to us today, is there a reason for hope and optimism, and what gets you excited about the future?
Well, I am excited about the future because I think, I started as a journalist reporting on these stories that we've written about in philanthrocapitalism, about philanthropy, and in The Road from Ruin, about companies putting values much more at the heart of a more long-term profit maximization strategy, and with a fair amount of skepticism. And then I found that I've been struck by how inspiring so many of the examples are, whether it be social entrepreneurs doing amazing things to organizations like Kiva, the online lending site, where millions of dollars are being lent by ordinary people to people who are small business people in the developing world, through to people like Bill Gates, who I guess I initially was covering when he was the evil monopolist at Microsoft, and now, he turns out to be someone who is unbelievably passionate and effective, I think, at saving millions of lives in the developing world, people who would be dying from malaria who, are not dying from malaria now. And I think, the fact that some of our brightest and successful business people are engaging in social change, people like Mike Bloomberg in New York as well, I think is a really helpful step forward and means that we have a better chance of solving some of these problems than when they were all being left to the bureaucrats.
Well, one of the examples you know, you share of that. So speaking of leaders and people that have actually created change here, and not just leaving it to the bureaucrats, as you say, but just actually people taking more control over trying to create social impact. There's a group that you referred to in the Philanthrocapitalism book called The Elders. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And then maybe part two of that, and albeit a little bit separate question, would be what can individuals do to be just more part of this social impact and this movement, if they will, even if they aren't linked with an organization?
Well, you know, I think The Elders is a really interesting example because, you know, I think one of the questions I have as I think about the role of the rich and in society is that, you know, we've actually over many decades won all these democratic rights. We've got the ability to shape our government, and we've got the United Nations, which is there, you know, as our global government in a way. And yet these institutions have not been very effective in some ways. And The Elders is an example, I think, of how only how a particular private approach can actually make a huge difference. The Elders was really the result of Richard Branson, the Virgin businessman, and Peter Gabriel, the former Genesis musician, thinking about Nelson Mandela and how you know, he might have actually played a role. If you flew Nelson Mandela, as Richard Branson was planning to, if you flew him to Baghdad on the eve of the American invasion of Baghdad and asked and got him to persuade Saddam Hussein to go into exile, you know, maybe that would have prevented that terrible war. Mm-hmm. And they weren't able to get Mandela there. It was a very close thing, apparently. But they, out of that discussion, they thought, Gabriel made the point, you know, villages, African villages have elders that people turn to at times of crisis. Why doesn't the global village have global elders? And why don't we get Nelson Mandela to appoint a group of 12, you know, really respected former heads of state and so forth, who will be our global elders, and then we'll get some philanthropists together and make sure that they're funded as an organization to go out and provide advice and wise counsel and so forth to the political leaders who face challenging situations. And that's what they've done. So they've got a group with people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu on there, and Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, and Kofi Annan, the former head of the UN, former President Jimmy Carter, and they're now properly funded to actually operate as a group to intervene on key issues, and they've played an important role in mediating in Kenya after there were the corrupted elections there and the rioting, and they helped broker peace between the two sides there. They've played an important role in Cyprus, dealing with between the Turkish Cypriots and the Greek Cypriots. They've been out to Darfur and tried to have an impact there. I think one of the issues they're looking at the moment is how do they use their credibility as sort of as elders to change the attitudes of the world's religions towards women. It wouldn't surprise me if we get a big initiative coming out of the elders on that front over the next few months, as Jimmy Carter's already resigned from his church because he felt that the church was oppressing women, and I think you'll see more initiatives coming out on that front. You know, you couldn't imagine such an organization being created under the auspices of the United Nations because it's just too autonomous, it's too free of the conventional rules of politics, and so it would be vetoed. And so this is where private philanthropy has stepped in and funded what I think could be a really powerful organization, powerful in the right way through using the influence of people of great integrity and not powerful in an abusive way.
Yes. And what a beautiful example. I love that these kind of groups exist and that you would bring these things to our attention, those of us who wouldn't have known otherwise. So I guess for me then, what can individuals do to have an impact that, you know, that we're not government leaders, we're not part of this elders group. What can we do as individuals to do something?
Well, you see, I think one of the other great reasons for optimism is that the technology is out there to allow lots of us with not much money, not much time, to actually start making more of a difference. Mm-hmm. I think one of the frustrations all of us have when we give to charity or we get involved in a non-profit is that we can't really tell whether it's making any difference or not.
Yeah.
We can't tell where our money has gone. What I like about an organization like Kiva, which I mentioned earlier, where you can actually go to kiva.org and there you're seeing pictures of farmers and small business people in Africa and other parts of the world, and you actually have the opportunity to lend money to them. Or there's an organization called Donors Choose, which is brilliant, I think, because it means it's classroom teachers in public schools across America who have a particular project that they want for their classroom that they can't fund out of their budget. And they just say, well, our kids would love to have this. Can you pay for it? And then you can literally see the school that you're giving the money to. You can see the project. And you get letters back from the kids saying thank you and explaining how it was used. And, you know, I think that kind of level of engagement, that kind of feedback, is really powerful.
Yes.
And I think the internet is making this stuff possible in a way that was never possible before.
There's a lot more transparency.
All sorts of new organizations. It gives you transparency. It gives you the ability to contact and actually interact. And I think it gives you one of the best things which is going to happen, which is, you know, so much of our traditional aid and charity has been us with the money and the time deciding on what's good for the people we're helping.
Yes.
And in fact, we're now going to be able to hear back from them whether we're actually giving them what they need. And I think that could really improve our effectiveness. The other thing, I mean, I talked to Bill Gates about this. The question I interviewed him, and the question was, you know, what message would he have for those of us that aren't the richest man in the world?
Yeah.
You know, what advice would he have? And he said, well, what you should do is really pick one issue that you really care about, and really learn about it, become expert in it, find out what the good organizations are, find out. And just devote yourself over the long term to doing something practical within that one area. And you know, one of the reasons that we all feel a bit ineffective is that we're just too scattergun in what we do.
Yes.
Really. And he was saying that anyone can make a difference if they really apply themselves to it, even if they don't necessarily have all the assets that he brings.
Matthew, I think that that's fantastic, and what a great way to summarize this whole conversation today, that everyone can make a difference. We just need to center on it and make it a purpose for us. It has been fantastic to have you on the show today, author of Philanthrocapitalism and so many other wonderful books, but I highly recommend people go out and find you. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We are delighted that you would be here, and from Roy and I, we both thank you. And for all of our listeners out there, we encourage people to email us at feedback@realrecognition.com. We look forward to hearing more from you. Thanks for listening to Real Recognition Radio. For more information about the Recognition Management Institute, please visit us at realrecognition.com. Again, we recommend that you go out there, find the book, Philanthrocapitalism, wonderful read. Until next time, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Saunderson and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.